and WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward. Always streaming on the ABC Civic News. Media app.
I'm Andy Field. ABC News has learned that an IT worker at former President Trump's Florida estate has entered into a cooperation agreement with Special Counsel Jack Smith in the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case. Attorney John Eastman surrendered to Fulton County authorities. He faces 9 counts in the Georgia 2020 election interference case.
Do you still think the election was stolen?
Absolutely.
Still?
No question.
Former President Trump expected to surrender in Georgia later this week. Republican 2024 presidential candidate Perry Johnson is suing the Republican Party over the criteria to qualify. For the first primary debate, 8 candidates will appear, all based on polling data.
The people at the RNC are making decisions and they have no idea what they're doing. And it's really ridiculous. Very corrupt.
Johnson tells ABC Stephen Portnoy he had polls that qualified. Harold has now weakened into a tropical depression and will dissipate soon. This is ABC News. A 7-year-old in the hospital recovering from a bear attack in New York's Westchester County. Officials say the responding crews are also being threatened by the bear, so they had to kill it. The boy's injuries are not considered to be life-threatening. One school is seeing a spike in COVID cases. Georgia's Morris Brown College reinstituting a mask mandate and prohibiting large gatherings. A hero's welcome for the Women's World Cup champs.
Nestas estrellas, no seríamos campeonas del mundo!
1,000 showed up in Madrid's Rio Park to celebrate with their national sporting heroes. After waiting for hours, the fans were delighted when the full squad and coach Jorge Vilda arrived and took to the stage. Spain's players gave speeches, then they sang and danced with their fans. World Cup bragging rights for the next 4 years. Tom Rivers, ABC News, at the Foreign Desk.
Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg says a web version of the Threads app will be rolling out in the coming days. Andy Field, ABC News.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers is urging the legislature to address needs in the child care industry ahead of a special session in September. Governor Evers plans to use more than $1 billion of the state's $4 billion budget surplus to, quote, stave off the looming fiscal cliff facing the state's child care industry. According to the press release, over 2,000 child care programs are projected to close, losing 4,880 child care jobs and leaving over 87,000 children in Wisconsin without child care. A conservative policy group filed an open records lawsuit on Tuesday against Wisconsin Secretary of State Sarah Godlewski, accusing her of blocking a request it hopes can shed light on the events that led to her appointment earlier this year. Godlewski was nominated for the role on March 17th after former Secretary of State Doug La Follette abruptly resigned, and Republican state legislators have called on Governor Tony Evers to hold a special election for the position. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
Don't let biased algorithms or degree screens or exclusive professional networks or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
I have Corrine Hendrickson, part of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Action Needed group.
The Joint Finance Committee, again in the middle of the night, took that out and said, well, hey, you have all this money coming from the federal government. Why don't you use that to create this program? Well, guess what? We proved it worked. Wages went up $2 an hour. There actually are a couple extra childcare businesses open now than there were about a year ago. And that's going to stop. Just Monday, we lost two.
Weekday morning, 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth
by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Wisconsin's home for daily conversations about the state's latest headlines and stories. Weekday mornings from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Manufacturing. And manufacturing investment, as you're seeing right here in this factory.
A building boom, a manufacturing boom, a jobs boom, a clean energy boom. Sounds like a good idea to me. For much more on all of these booms and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site formerly known as Twitter at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So since all of the disaster that's going on in Hawaii, the email box has been full of conspiracy theories. You know, again, we're back to raking grass. I mean, this is the part that blew my mind. I literally had someone say, well, the whole reason that the fire happened, you know, Rick, is because there was all this dry grass laying around that nobody cut and raked up and put away. And I'm going, really? And I go, I've never been there, so I don't have the firsthand knowledge to go, no, that's stupid. So I decided I should probably find someone who does. So that's why we've asked Angelo Villagomez to come talk with us. Angelo is the Senior Fellow for Conservation Policy at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website. Angelo, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, thanks for having me on the show.
So I got to start with the most obvious ridiculous of it. Was it the grass? Did you not cut the grass? Is that what this is all about?
Yeah, you know, so ironically, the grass was a big part of it. And, you know, I look at this and I look at the science, and it was sort of maybe three conditions that led to this disaster. And one of them was the grass, but it's not the raking of the grass. It was these invasive grasses. And you know, the landscape of Hawaii has changed over the last 100, 200 years since they became, you know, a state. And they changed the hydrology, and water is being taken out of streams and rivers, and it's being sent to agriculture. So there was, you know, all this invasive grass. This time of year is also, it just happens to be the driest part of the year in this part of the island. And they typically only get like an inch or two of rain in a month. But, you know, due to climate change, we have a warmer atmosphere, we have warmer waters. It was actually drier than normal. So it was like already the driest part of the year, and they were experiencing drought. And then the thing that really set it off was this typhoon that went south of the island. And I've, you know, following friends on Facebook, they're posting videos of these 80-mile-per-hour winds just whipping across these islands, you know, up the hills, down the hills. And one of my friends told me that, like, when they were outside, it was so windy that they could hardly stand up. And then, you know, a fire was lit like that. You have 80-mile-per-hour winds, you have dry grasses, you have high temperatures and a drought. And, you know, we ended up with the horrible situation that is Hawaii. And, you know, even just to think about the loss that has taken place there, I think over 100 people have died in Lahaina, and those are just the people that they know about. There's still, last number I heard was there's about 850 people who are missing, and, you know, in all likelihood, they perished in the fires. And if, you know, you see video of what happened there, everything's gone. You know, houses burnt to the ground. The only thing left there is, you know, twisted metal. People lost, generations worth of memories and belongings, and just a horrible, horrible situation.
So, well, I mean, a whole community.
It wasn't the raking of the grass. It was probably more the invasive grasses and climate change that is the real culprit here.
So the question is, because, you know, the sad reality is we keep seeing these horrible weather events, call whatever you want, these disasters. And me, you know, looking at the reality that disaster capitalism is here to stay, that every time there's one of these things that happen, you know, someone's going to get rich off of it while everyone else gets a lot poorer. How do we then make sure that this doesn't happen again? How do we respond differently? You know, policy wise, is there anything we can do, or are we just screwed? Yeah. I mean, because there's part of me that goes, I don't know how you stop a giant fire like that from, you know, when. Someone told me the winds were, what did you say, 80 miles an hour?
80 miles an hour, yeah.
The fire was moving a mile a minute?
Yeah.
I'm going, how do you run from that?
Yeah, you can't. The sad thing is that right now, like, this is going to happen again. And if you watch the weather reports, there's a hurricane forming in the Gulf of Mexico right now. Just earlier this week, we had the first hurricane to hit Southern California in a century. And, you know, I'm a big baseball fan, and there was this picture of Dodger Stadium that was circulating on Twitter, where it showed Dodger Stadium completely, you know, the parking lot was completely flooded. I'm here in Washington, D.C., and, you know, our skies are hazy, and we're getting ozone alerts because of the fires that are burning in California. And, you know, I'm a little bit younger than you. We were talking about high school earlier. I graduated in 96. But this is the stuff that scientists have been predicting for like 30 or 40 years, these extreme weather events. And, you know, when it comes to climate change, you know, it's kind of funny, you know, conservatives, whenever it snows, they'll say, hey, look, it's cold. Climate change isn't real. And then sometimes, you know, the liberals do the opposite. They'll say, hey, it's hot outside. That proves that climate change is true. But, you know, the reality is that you got to look at the data. And when you look at the data, it's just crystal clear. There are flashing red lights that this extreme weather is coming from the greenhouse gases that are fueling the warming of our atmosphere and our oceans.
No, and bad things are happening. I mean, I saw a report from Florida, the water 100 degrees, and then you're surprised when there's flesh-eating bacteria, attacking swimmers. I mean, we're going to have to figure out how to deal with this stuff, because clearly I don't think we're moving fast enough to do anything to change the direction we're going. And, you know, I think of Rex Tillerson, who, when he was the head of ExxonMobil, said, well, you know, we'll adapt. You know, technology, we'll figure out how to use technology and we'll adapt. It's what we always do. And I'm going, yeah, if you're going to be buying water and buying air and all of this and living in a bubble, maybe that's how we'll adapt after we've scorched the earth to nothing. But do you think let's start there. Do you think we're doing enough? Do you think we're moving in the right direction? Do you think the administration's at least got us going in the right direction?
This is a long journey, man. I think there is a long, long way to go. We've had some great legislation in the last couple of years with the bipartisan infrastructure law, and then the Inflation Reduction Act. That needs to be implemented. And, you know, we're calling this, you know, hard hat conservation, right? We need to build the stuff that is going to get us off of our addiction to fossil fuels. And so, you know, this is going to be offshore wind. It's going to be onshore wind. We're going to need those critical minerals to make the batteries so that we can get off fossil fuels. And this isn't going to happen overnight. I heard you talking earlier, like, we don't have the workers. And so we're going to have to figure out how do we get the workers. And we're going to have to figure out where are we going to source these minerals from, the minerals that are going to go into the batteries. And a lot of these minerals are coming from other countries. And that's also going to be an issue that we're going to have to deal with.
Yeah, we've got a lot of problems. But here's where my true north is, because you're the smart guy on climate. You're the guy on this conservation stuff. I'm just a truck driver. what I want to make sure is that I leave a place for my children worth inheriting. I don't want them to have to be saddled with all of the sins of the past and suffer the consequences of you know, what we're doing right now. So the hope is that, you know, smart people like you will help us usher us in a direction. What would you want to help move us in a direction toward?
Yeah, so I mean, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. I actually think there's kind of two crises that we're facing right now. One is it's the climate crisis, and that's being driven by fossil fuels. And so we need to implement Biden's clean energy programs, and we need to use fewer fossil fuels and find other ways to power our cars, power our homes, power our businesses and our industries. The other side of that is sort of just like old school conservation, man. You know, like people love our national parks. And we can't forget about the need to protect habitats with our national parks and our national wildlife refuges. Same thing on the ocean. We have sanctuaries and national marine monuments. So, you know, we actually do have a lot of the policy tools to protect biodiversity and to reduce our carbon footprint. But we need leaders who are going to be brave enough to put those measures in place. And then not just to pass legislation, but then to ensure that they actually get funded so that our national parks have rangers. So, that, you know, they have the infrastructure, that the Jeeps and the boats have diesel so that they can actually go out there and enforce these sorts of things. Unless, of course, I realize they should have electric cars.
I was going, okay.
Yeah.
No, but here's the thing. I've said this for a while. We're not going to get off fossil fuels entirely. There's always going to be a use and a need for them. For me, it's right now, you know, cutting down on the amount that we're using and then maybe cutting it back. I don't think you're ever going to get rid of it entirely, at least not in my lifetime. But at least start moving in a direction that gets us to where we're not using more of it and making things worse. I mean, we've done a pretty bad job already, I think. I have a friend who all he keeps saying is, we just need to plant more trees. We can consume as much fossil fuels as we want. We just need to plant more trees, Angelo. What do you make of that argument? You know, we could burn all the fossil fuels we want. We just need to plant trees, offsets.
We can. There's also there are plans out there to remove carbon dioxide from the air. And while the idea has some merit, and I do think that the planting trees, like they're called nature-based solutions. I do think that they can play a role, but they're not going to be the silver bullet that solves all of our issues. Clearly, we do need a lot of trees. And in fact, right now, as a species, we're doing the opposite. Deforestation is ever increasing, and we need to stop cutting down trees, and we can also plant some more. But like the real thing that needs to happen is we need to cut back on our fossil fuel uses, and that's yes, we're probably going to continue to use diesel and fuel for many, many more years, but we can make it more efficient. But at the same time, we can drive up the types of energies that are renewable. And, these can be good paying union jobs.
And they should be. Anytime I think about the environment, I think about the political analysis of George Carlin, who said, the planet's going to be fine. The planet will be fine. It's us that's screwed. And I keep looking around. I look at these fires. I look at these hurricanes. I look at the flooding. I look at all of these disasters that are happening. And I go, he wasn't wrong.
Yeah. I mean, eventually people come around. We do need to keep up that drumbeat of empathy for the people who are like truly suffering. And the saddest thing about all of this is that the people who are going to suffer the most are going to be the people who are least responsible. And the people who are least able to respond to some of these things, right? A lot of folks, you can't just throw, a case of water in the Land Rover and drive off. A lot of these folks didn't have cars. And they had literally nowhere to drive off to. There's also a justice aspect to all of this of, the least of us are going to be the ones who are harmed the most.
So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, obviously the island is torched. And the president went there, and the president took a beating for, it took him so long to get there. And I hate when this happens. And for every president, it's the same thing they did to Trump and the same thing they did to Obama. You didn't, or the same thing they did to Bush. You didn't get there fast enough. Well, you know what? You don't want to use up resources. You don't want to, you don't want to make the situation worse. How about you just send the resources that people need? So I guess the last line of question is, what do the people there need, and how fast can, is Biden doing enough, and can we do more to help those folks?
Yeah, I mean, Biden's doing a lot. And I agree with you that, you know, actually the last thing you want is a president to fly off to a disaster zone in the first week, because that's just going to cause chaos. And it's actually not going to have any of the help any of the people. You know, at this time, they're still doing recovery. They're still searching the ruins and looking for bodies. So people are dealing with trauma, and they're dealing with shock. People have they're going to have mental health issues from this, you know, trauma that they're dealing with. But people need, they need hot meals, they need diapers, they need blankets, they need a roof over their head. And the Red Cross is doing a great job. I saw that they're providing 20,000 hot meals every single day. The Biden administration has given all of the victims $700 to help them meet their immediate needs. My understanding is that they're providing assistance to get people into hotels, get people to Airbnbs, you know, get a roof over their head so that they're safe. And there's also business assistance that is on the way. So a lot is being done, and it's probably a little too soon for us to determine whether it's enough. But, you know, but for people, you know, I have a friend, Saul, and, you know, he lost his house, and he lost all of the belongings in there. And you just imagine what it would be like to lose literally everything overnight. And so this is going to be a very long-term process of recovery. You know, right now it's, you know, save lives, help, you know, people who are suffering, get a roof over their head. In a couple of weeks, the rebuilding is going to begin. And so they're, you know, they're going to need plywood, they're going to need nails and hammers. But, you know, hopefully, you know, as time goes on, they can also find some joy and start to rebuild some of the memories of, you know, the beautiful island town. And, you know, that may be years off. And so it'll be incumbent upon everybody to keep, you know, keep that drumbeat of empathy going, you know, not just for the people in Hawaii, but for the people who are suffering all these extreme weather events all across the country.
No, sadly, there's so many of them that it's hard to keep track.
Yeah. I mean, the floods in Vermont were devastating. We've moved on to the next thing. And so, I really feel for people. It's a difficult time.
But Angelo, I appreciate the thoughts. I appreciate you giving us the real deal. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us again down the road, maybe on better circumstances.
Yeah, thanks, man. Appreciate
maybe you can
it.
Tell.
I love talking about fish. Is there you ever talk about fish?
No, when I scuba dive, yeah. But
scuba dive. Oh, I can talk to you about scuba diving.
Hawaii is one of the places I've always wanted to go.
Awesome.
Maybe we'll do that.
Great, man.
Thanks so much. I appreciate the time. Angelo Villagomez, Senior Fellow for Conservation Policy at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website if you want to check out the work that they do. Right back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Wednesday in Milwaukee, the big child's debate's going to happen. I'm vacillating between do I bother talking about it, because, you know, it is kind of, you know, there's a major political party in the U.S. and they're trying to find their candidate, And then there's just nobody on the stage. I mean, there's, it's weird to me. And it's one of these things where, you know, if you didn't make the cut, which was very low, very simple to get, if you didn't do that, you should probably give it up because you're not getting any attention. Because the threshold was you had to get 40,000 individual donors. 40,000 people had to give you at least a dollar. I had to get at least 200 from each of 20 states. Put these into place so you don't have a bunch of crackpots just showing up going, hey, I can self-fund myself. And you had to have at least 1% in three national polls or two national polls and a state poll. So it seemed, and of course you had to pledge support to allegiance to the party. There is that. And you only got eight people who were able to do that. Very limited thing. But what I find interesting, and we've talked about this before, you had the governor of North Dakota, this Burgum guy, who was giving out, what was it, $20 gift cards to everybody who sent him a dollar. And I remember saying, you know, this seems kind of like bribery. And then we find out now that Asa Hutchinson, he was paying college students $20 for every family member, friend, acquaintance, anybody who would give a dollar. And I started thinking about, you know, why didn't I think of this sooner? I could have organized a bunch of people to give these idiots a dollar and collected $20. I could have made a fortune. I could have asked every person in the audience to go and, hey, donate a dollar to these idiots, get them on the child stage so they can yell at each other, and then send me $20. What was I thinking? There was a missed out. There could have been my million, man. And what's interesting is, you know, while some of them did do the paying, this Francis Suarez, the mayor of Miami, evidently didn't. This is what I understand. He supposedly he made the same offer. You give me a dollar, we'll give you 20. This gift card exchange, but evidently it's not happened. So now he's under investigation by the FBI for, you know, for bribery, something going on there. But this is also the guy who said, if you don't make the minimum number of stuff, you should drop out. Well, he didn't make it. So maybe he should drop out. Now, the heavy eight will be Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, former governor of South Carolina, Nikki Haley, former vice president Mike Pence, former New Jersey governor Chris Christie, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, lunatic entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy, Burgum, the North Dakota governor, and former Arkansas governor Asa Hutchinson. Do you see anything interesting in that? I see DeSantis and Ramaswamy and Christie yelling at each other. I see a lot of that. I don't see much else. I don't see much entertaining. And I definitely don't see any policy ideas. I don't see them coming out and saying, look, you know, we need to do something that our party isn't doing. Because I don't know if you've noticed, the Republican House hasn't passed anything to help you. They have passed no legislation that is going to make the lives of working people any better. And this is the part that I've got some frustration with. Now, look, the party's a train wreck. I mean, go down the list of, you know, of all of the stuff going on and you go, well, it's no wonder they don't have any policy. They're too busy defending themselves from going to jail. For instance, Trump's lawyer, John Eastman, evidently he's turned himself in. Yeah, he's going to have to get himself out on bail. We now know that Leonard Leo, the guy who was the guy head of the Federalist Society and one of Trump's judicial advisors, the D.C. Attorney General's probing into his network of what was it, $1.6 billion? And you look at all of this money, and it's the money I keep coming back to. It is the money. The fact that these candidates got $20 to give you to say, give me a dollar so I can get one more donor. You don't see a problem with our system, and it's just drunk with money. And I remember when I saw the Burgum story right from the beginning. I'm like, I can't believe this is legal. I can't believe you can get away with this. And yet they're doing it all across the board. All for show. And the thing is you know, Trump is leading by what, 40, 50, some outrageous number. Now, what's interesting is there's a new article over at The Atlantic from a former federal judge, J. Michael Ludig and Lawrence Tribe. And they're making the argument that the Constitution disqualifies Trump from holding public office. I do think at some point you're going to hear all of the Republican candidates point to this and saying, look, he can't run. So he's got to be disqualified. And I think this is the way Republicans are going to get rid of Trump. They're going to do it. I know Democrats were trying, and the folks over at Crew, who we had on a couple of weeks ago, were saying the exact same thing. It's not going to come from outside the House. The phone is ringing inside. And if Trump's going to get ousted, it's going to be from inside. Palace intrigue. And who's going to benefit from it? Will it be DeSantis? Will that debate matter then? And that's where I'm going back and forth. Right now, I don't care. But if they do disqualify Trump, who is the guy who's going to be the bearer of the party? And does Trump run as a third party? Does he take his MAGA maniacs? Because this is the reason I don't think they've done it already. Does he take all the MAGA hats, all the red hats, and go back with them? And, you know, Biden then walks away with the election. That could be interesting. Watch how this is why you play the game. This is why you watch. This is why you pay attention to this nonsense and insanity. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1980. That was the day that Joyce Miller became the first woman ever elected to the executive board of the AFL-CIO. In her 2012 obituary, the New York Times described Joyce's commitment to women's rights in the labor movement, writing, "Miss Miller saw union membership, collective bargaining, and labor contracts as the road to equality for working women. And she believed that women should be a part of union management to make sure that attention was paid to issues like equal opportunity, equal pay, parental leave, child care, health insurance, and discrimination in the workplace." Joyce grew up in Chicago, where she earned her master's degree in education from the University of Chicago. She first entered the labor movement as a worker at a gumball factory while attending college. After graduation, she became the education director for the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union in Pittsburgh. She remained dedicated to union education for rank and file members. Joyce was a founding member of the Coalition of Labor Union Women, or CLU. She served as CLU's East Coast vice president, eventually being elected CLU's president in 1977, a position she would hold for 15 years. Under her leadership, CLU worked as a powerful voice for women's reproductive rights, improving childcare, and increasing the number of women in union leadership positions. In 1993, President Bill Clinton named Joyce Miller the executive director of the Glass Ceiling Commission. The purpose of the commission was to gather testimony about women's experience in the workplace and to draft a report of their findings. Of her career, Joyce said, "I came to the labor movement with stars in my eyes. I saw it as a vehicle for social change, and I never changed my mind." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Last week, T-Mobile, my cell phone provider, pinged me with a rude message. "Henceforth, we will screw you out of an extra $5 a month." What? Had I done something wrong? No. Would I be getting some added benefit for my $5? No. It seems that T-Mobile bean counters have just arbitrarily decided that we customers who use credit cards to pay our phone bills online must pay an extra fiver each month as a payment processing fee. Yes, we're to pay them to take our money. Bonnie and Clyde were not that brazen. You can avoid the add-on if you give your bank account number to T-Mobile, allowing it and who knows who else to have direct access to your personal stash of cash. No. Tut-tut, say the T-Mobilers. Your private info is perfectly secure with us. Do they think we have sucker wrappers around our heads? Just 8 months ago, their security system let thieves swipe the personal data of 37 million customers, including names, account numbers, addresses, phone numbers, and birth dates. Well, sniff free market ideologues, just switch to a competitor. But AT&T, Verizon, etc. have all adopted the exact same thieving give us your bank account scheme. Phone service today is a shared monopoly, not a free market, and it's now copycatting airlines, banks, and other monopolistic profiteers that constantly fabricate add-ons and pricing gimmicks to gouge consumers. This is Jim Hightower saying, T-Mobile rose to telecom prominence a decade ago by attacking its rivals for overcharging and abusing consumers. It ran ads publicly demanding that AT&T and others stop their greedy practices, quote, because it's the right thing to do. But now that it's a monopolistic giant, T-Mobile's new line is that might makes right. So it has joined the industry's consumer abuse greed game.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some really good news, and we've been talking about this for a while, that the workers at the VA have been fighting for a better contract, some decent wages, some decent working conditions, but also with modernization, help do their job better, get our veterans the care that they need, that they deserve, that we promise them. This is big stuff. And I'm thrilled to hear that finally, after 6 years of negotiation, that they're able to get this done. And that's why I've asked Bill Wetmore to come talk with us. Bill's the third executive vice president for AFGE's National VA Council. You can check out their website, afge.org. Bill, thanks for taking time for us.
I'm happy to do it.
So this is kind of a big deal. I mean, this is something we've been talking about with you guys for a while. The need for a new contract, the need for better modernization to get the job done. Big thing?
Yeah, it's a very big thing. We as you said, we were negotiating. We had a lot of litigation to try and move the process along the way we wanted it, and had a big giant settlement back in 20 to start us kind of restart the clock and get involved again. We had a meeting with the secretary and our national president and some of us on the negotiating team and some people otherwise, and just kind of brought it home all of a sudden in a couple of days after we were kind of afraid that we were at it for years still, but both sides made significant movement, and we've got a very good contract that we're very happy with.
No, and look, you know, we've been talking to AFGE folks for years, and the fact that you've, I remember, the former president, J. David Cox, saying there were 49,000 workers at the VA short. We're not getting the care to the people that we need. And it comes back to the contract and not having the wages and all that stuff to bring people in. I understand this is going to help fill some of that. Am I accurate?
Yeah, it speeds up the process. The department has, I mean, any federal agency has some real problems with bringing people on board. The agency, VA, has had particular problems relative to others in significant measure because we have so many healthcare workers, and we need to be very careful. We don't just hire any doctor, any nurse, any podiatrist, any whatever expanded function dental auxiliaries. We have eight different types of what we call Title 38 people who are very much engaged in putting their hands on veterans and helping them, trying to restore them to, if we can't get them to fully recover from their injuries and their diseases, then at least we get them to, hopefully, the goal is to at least have them be able to take anything, and sometimes that doesn't even work, unfortunately, but because sometimes it's just they're just too injured. But again, that kind of, it's a very special mission that the department has, and the bargaining unit is very committed to the mission. We We show that every year in the surveys that happen across the federal government, that VA employees are more committed to the mission than any other group of employees across the government.
Well, as it was explained to me, a good number of the 300,000 some members that you have at the VA, a good many of them are former veterans themselves. So, you know, they themselves are dealing with some issues and dealing with, you know, having to go through the system. So it seems to me that they would be the people that you want in the bargaining unit, working there to make sure that, you know, not only do the people that they're caring for get the best care possible that they need and deserve, that they themselves get the care that they should get.
Yes, that's absolutely true, Rick. I couldn't agree more. We have a higher percentage of veterans, and that's all, you know, the way it should be, I think, entirely. There's no more deserving group in the American population than the veterans who've served. Some of them obviously have been severely injured, but even ones who come back with just minor injuries, we need to treat them the best way we can medically and to give them the benefits that they so richly deserve.
No, at the end of the day, and I said this, you know, years ago when we were getting involved in misadventures around the world, that if you're going to send people into harm's way, if you're going to make these choices, you got to take care of them when they come back, no matter what the cost, no matter what we have to do. You have to do this as a matter of absolute. And sadly, you know, I don't think, you know, historically we've done a great job. I go back to when I was a kid, you know, growing up in a housing project during the 70s. I remember those guys coming back from Vietnam and just being dumped into our community and forgotten about with horrible drug and alcohol problems, broken bodies and broken minds. And I never want to see that ever again, nor should we ever allow that to happen, which is why I'm glad organizations like yours are out there fighting for folks.
Yeah, we do fight. We fight hard every week. We go to legislation and try and make sure that we get the funds necessary to treat everybody. And we want to expand treatment to more veterans. Right now we take care of about 9 million veterans in different ways. And the benefits side of the house is takes care of probably maybe 15 million total. But we still have a ways to go. There's still more veterans out there. Unfortunately, we have a homeless problem in veterans that's kind of more a bigger problem than it is for the general population, and even worse, the suicide rate. And as much as we work on both of those problems and make real progress in both of those areas, there's still a long way to go.
Now, you're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Bill Wetmore. Bill is the third executive vice president for AFGE, National VA Council. You can check out their website, afge.org. Now, you know, in talking about all of these special situations, you know, it's one of the reasons that I fear down the road someone wants to again talk about privatizing the VA or putting our veterans into the private system. You guys have specialized care, specialized, you know, treatment plans. You mm-hmm. see things that aren't in the public sphere, which is why the institutional knowledge, I think, is so important, and why a contract like the one you just got, which I hope in a minute you'll explain exactly what's in it, is going to keep those people in place to ensure that a continuity of care, to ensure that knowledge center doesn't get destroyed. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, Rick. We have great specialties that really don't get seen as much in the private sector. I mean, we have the prosthetics, which are a very big, important part of our mission. We, in particular, take care of the PTSD. That's something that happens in private lives, but obviously it's much more prevalent among our veteran population. We are engaged in a lot of research. We were the people that we've invented a couple of things. The first heart transplant, what happened at a VA facility. The MRIs and CAT scans were significantly pioneered. We pioneered the computerized healthcare system so that a veteran who is in New York and goes to California, will that California VA doctor can see all that veteran's records and know what treatment has been working with them and what might need to be adjusted because there's been some problem with it. And so, yeah, we're kind of cutting edge generally in healthcare. The there's an organization that examines hospitals every 3 years, and our hospitals average out in the low 90s in terms of their tests, and the average, actually the average private hospital is more along the low 80s, the high 80s. So we do a very good job, objectively speaking, as much as you can objectify healthcare. And also, and we keep working at it, we still, our significant part of our budget is for research. We're working on trying to, we create new drugs, new methods of treatment. Obviously the prosthetic stuff is a very big important thing for us. So in many ways, I don't want to list them all. In many ways, the healthcare system that the veterans are experiencing is overall probably the best in the world.
Let me ask you about the contract. 6 years. What took so long? How is it? You know, this is the thing that gets me. How does it take so long to do this? 6 years to get a contract. It doesn't seem like it should be this difficult. We want to keep the best people in place to take care of the best people. We need to pay people. We need to give them dignity and respect. How hard is this to figure out?
Well, that question, management may be in a better position to answer that question. I was kind of stumped on occasion myself, Rick, but let me say that we had a lot of litigation. Management was not bargaining in good faith, and we had four grievances on their failure to bargain in good faith for a number of reasons. I don't want to get too deep into the legal weeds here, but the fact was that they weren't, and that was holding up the process. They were slow. They would go into caucus for one occasion. They were in caucus for 2.5 days, didn't talk to us at all, and it was normal for them to go into caucus for four to 6 hours in a day. So you can't bargain if they're not in the room, and they would go off and they would come back. And it was like, there were more than once I said to them, you were gone all this time and this is what you came up with. It was terrible. But you can't make progress if somebody's not going to actually have a sincere desire to make progress. And again, we won those grievances. A third party looked at the facts and found that management was engaged in bad faith bargaining pretty consistently. So eventually the whole bargaining that we had for the first 2.5 or so years just kind of fell apart. And so we started all over again, basically. It's a significant reason why it took as long as it did. We started from the beginning, and new ground rules, new whole settlement agreement to kind of resolve the litigation that we prevailed in.
Yeah.
And so then we started negotiating again and again. I don't know that I'm confident that it was only because the secretary, Dennis McDonough, stepped in and was concerned about the lack of progress. I have to imagine. He never said that out loud, but I can't imagine why else.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask you, because look, I understand the 4 years under Trump. I get that, right. Because he was to be quite honest, from the outside, and maybe I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but from the outside, it seemed that he was hostile to AFGE and to unions as a whole. So it's not surprising to me at all that you had 4 years of stalemate. Kind of surprising it's taken this long during the Biden years. So interesting to hear that the secretary is kind of pushed in that. Do you think the secretary pushed in that direction?
Yes. Yes, I do. I have to say about a significant problem. I mean, what Trump did to us and to other federal unions was he reduced illegally. I mean, and that's other litigation that we won in federal court. He reduced illegally our ability to represent people by taking away our official time. So we're doing it on our spare time. We're doing it on the weekends. We're doing it at night. We're trying to find some time during lunch to talk to people and try and find out what we needed to do to help them. And similarly, he kicked us out of the offices. We didn't have offices. We had to go out and rent offices or work. I worked from home, and then took all our equipment away. So it was government furnished equipment. And but again, all of that was determined to be illegal, and they had to pay us millions of dollars to rectify the violations that they did to the agreements that we had. They just ignored the agreements that we had on those things and a number of other things. And again, the third parties came in some cases, the Federal Labor Relations Authority or federal court system found that this all was illegal, and they had to fix it. But that was a significant problem. And to some degree, I mean, we accused, and I think it's reasonable, we were looking at some of management's proposals that look very much like the kind of thing that the ex-president, the most recent ex-president, wanted to, in terms of treating veterans. They were, and because treating us is basically treating veterans. We're the people that serve veterans. If we can't serve employees, then we can't serve veterans. And the statistics are in. Places that have good labor manager relations are effective places to work. That they actually, in terms of the VA, there's a direct correlation between places where, and there were places that had good labor management relations, and there are now. And those places perform better. Those hospitals, those regional offices, those cemeteries, those are the three things that we do to veterans. We provide them health, we provide them benefits, we provide them memorial affairs. And those places all work much better when the labor and management get along and realize that the reason we're here is taking care of veterans. Yeah. And while management has said that many times, it seems like really what they have wanted to do, some of them clearly want to do, is actually get rid of labor union.
And there is the bottom line. And who would have guessed that happy employees would be good employees? Who would have thought happy workplaces would be more productive and better, have better outcomes? Who could have ever imagined right. such a thing? Right. As I understand, you got this contract. This is going to hopefully move in the right direction and get things done. Congratulations. I wish you guys the best. And maybe you come back and talk to us again about how this is working out well.
Sure. Did you want me to say anything about the contract itself?
Or? Sure. Real quick.
Sure.
What did you get?
So what we did was we allowed selections to be made from appointments from rated and certified applicants. We reduced the time for postings from 15 workdays to 8 calendar days. We've allowed management to go ahead, the selecting official, to just go ahead and move without having the panels that normally the department had. We've just gone ahead and tried to streamline this process. In short, that's what the secretary asked for, and we gave it to him. So, again, I appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts with you and your listening audience. Again, it's a great, we hope that we can reduce the hiring times and improve the number of employees who are there to serve veterans.
Well, it's good stuff. Bill, I appreciate the time. Good luck. I wish you the best, and I hope you'll come back again real soon. Thanks so much.
Excellent. Thank you, Rick.
Bill Wetmore, he is the third executive vice president there at the AFGE National VA Council. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the top. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1945. That was the day five women working for United Airlines formed the first union for airline stewardesses. Those women were Ada Brown, Frances Hall, Edith Lauterbach, Sally Tomitz, and Sally Watt. They called their new organization the Airline Stewardesses Association. The women elected Ada Brown as their first president. Stewardesses faced many workplace challenges. Ada Brown explained, "We had no rights. Let's put it that way. We were at the mercy of the company. Flight attendants were not permitted to marry. They had to meet strict height, weight, and appearance standards. Many times they had to put up with being referred to as girls while working long hours for low pay. They were expected to retire or take a job on the ground by the age of 32. The five women who organized the new union wanted to improve the conditions
under which they work. Within months, they had signed up 75% of their co-workers at United. The stewardesses at United had not received a pay increase for 15 years. The new union won a raise in starting wages from $125 to $155 a month. They also were able to establish a grievance procedure. Yet, it was not until the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 that the women had the ability to address some of the more sexist workplace requirements. Today, the union goes by the name Association of Flight Attendants. It represents nearly 60,000 workers at 18 airlines. Each year, the AFA gives the Ada Brown Greenfield Lifetime Achievement Award in recognition of women and men who have made a difference for their union. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program or any of our programs, make sure you check out the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you will find ours. Now, I'm not fat shaming, not doing that, but the odds makers, are betting on Thursday's weigh-in, because evidently when Trump gets arrested, and I guess they've told him show up around 3 o'clock in the morning, if you want to get in and out, because, you know, it fills up during the day. You could be sitting here for several hours. You want to talk about treating him like a common criminal? I don't know that I agree with this. But anyway, according to the Daily Mail, people are betting on Trump's weight because they're going to weigh him. They're betting on the over-under, 273.5 pounds. 77%. Of gamblers have taken the over. And I got to tell you, I'm taking the over. There's just no way. There's no way he's under 273.5. Cause look, he's like 6'4". I mean, he's a big guy. You know, so I'm going with the over. Again, not fat shaming. I'm just saying he's over. Even though, you know, the perfect physical, they said he was like 238. No. Remember the guy with the blade hand? He had a glove that looked like Freddy Krueger. It was a while ago. He was chasing down some Black Lives Matter folk. He was sentenced to, 25 years in prison for each count of attempted murder. Scheduled October 13th for his sentencing. I saw this image and I'm going, what exactly is this guy on his hand? I remember this when it happened. And I'm going, what were you thinking? I don't think he was thinking. And this is one of these weird places where we've become so angry and hate-filled and in the camp that you think you can get away with this stuff. 25 years in prison. He's 57 years old. I don't think he's going to do well with a long-term sentence. Just kind of throwing it out there. Got a couple of emails from folks questioning my thoughts on the Republican Party pushing Trump out. Look, I think they're going to make a calculus. At some point, is Trump so destructive, down ticket, down ballot, that they got to throw him overboard? Because he's only going to get worse. Have you been paying attention? He looks like someone's cornered. He's been acting like someone who just a little off. And as more of this information keeps coming out, I think he's going to continue losing support. He's not generating new voters. He's going to lose people, especially as more of the very best people. Because remember, none of these people testifying, none of these people who are been indicted, none of these folks who are jumping ship, none of them are Democrats. It's like the January 6th commission's hearings. None of those people who testified were Democrats. They were all the inner circle. And this thing with Mark Meadows, I don't know if you saw the New York Times piece today on Meadows and, you know, how Meadows is, you know, masterfully manipulated the system to keep himself from any federal indictments. Now, you know, the Georgia indictment is something different, but, you know,
you knew he was the songbird. You knew he was the guy who was telling everything because he wants to save his own skin. And look, I don't blame him. Normally you've got not good things to say about a rat or a snitch. But, you know, in this case, knowing that Trump has no loyalty to anyone, I don't know that if you're, you know, facing some kind of indictments, do you not go, hey, you know what? I'm going to save myself. And I think that's going to happen a lot, which is why the unindicted co-conspirators, why they haven't been named yet, because they're waiting for a bunch of those people to turn and sing. And if I'm Trump, I got to be wondering. I got to be wondering, you know, how many people are singing behind his back? Now, this story today that came out is interesting to me, that this guy, you know, has one of the Trump lawyers, and he's toeing the party line. No, we didn't try and touch the video. No. He goes and gets another lawyer, and now, I'm gonna recant. I'm gonna take back that statement, and I'm gonna tell you what now really happened. Now, we didn't need him to flip like that. You had to know that Trump would do that, because it's something that, if you listen to Michael Cohen at all, you know what kind of person this is. And this is why I struggle, because
you're listening to WLAK 1260 AM Amory and WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward. Always streaming on the Civic Media
ABC
app.
News.